Hi, you're with Truth News Radio Australia. Welcome back to the show. Well, in the second hour of today's show, I'm bringing you an interview which was conducted several years ago, actually 2005. And the interview is between myself and my mother, Shirley Fenton. And this interview has actually been played on Truth News Radio, but it was before we became a live show. And I thought it may be interesting for our live listeners to get this interview because it contains some quite interesting and original descriptions and discussion of events that happened around the time of the Kennedy assassination. My family was living in the United States at that time. My father was born an American and was served in the Second World War. And after that, he traveled and lived in many different countries. And he was a pilot. He actually died when I was a teenager. But he left America after the Kennedy assassination feeling fairly disgruntled and cynical about the political process there. He believed it was a conspiracy from the beginning. He never bought in to the Warren Commission. He never believed the lone assassin theory. And I heard a lot of this when I was young. It was a constant theme that my father would talk about, is that he knew that Kennedy had been assassinated by some kind of cabal, some kind of conspiracy. And it really bothered him. Kind of poisoned his attachment to the US, and that is why he never really went back apart from a few visits. So this event, which of course is very important to many people, is an important part of my life as well. And back in 2005, I did an impromptu interview with my mother down in Canberra, where she lives, Canberra being the capital city of Australia. And we just discussed a whole range of things, and I've edited this back. And what I'm giving you is some excerpts from the interview. And what we'll start off with here is her description of some of the things that were going on at the time leading up to the Kennedy assassination, the feelings she had about it, and people she spoke to around about that time. And it's not just about Kennedy, it's about the whole political zeitgeist in America at that time. So I'll start the interview now, and we'll move into the next segment after the break. So please stay with us. I hope you find this a worthwhile listen.
Well, of course, the people that we mixed with and who were our friends were all people who saw him as a great new hope. He seemed for the first time to be a leader who had a world outlook, which was a view of the world outside the United States, which very few politicians up to that time had ever had. He was a very educated man, and he had lived in many parts of the world, and he had a feeling for the whole world outside the United States. That's one of the things I remember most strongly of why people that I knew liked him. They felt this is something new. This is not just a tired old politician again who's just thinking about the United States all the time. He has an outside view.
Were you worried during that period about the Soviet Union and nuclear weapons?
Well, I can't say that Ed and I were worried about it. We knew. This is at the time of Cuba, of course. We knew that there was talk about the Soviets having nuclear weapons in Cuba. And I can't say that we were really worried about it because we were quite left-wing people. And we didn't really see the Soviet Union as a very terrifying enemy, because we knew there were things wrong in the United States. Now, when we came to live in the United States, we came directly from Colombia to Miami. And in those days, Miami was full of refugees from Cuba who had all come across in boats fleeing from Castro. This is the story that we heard on radio and in the newspapers. But in the motel we were staying, there were many Cuban refugees staying there. And they all said, oh yes, Castro is a very bad man, very terrible man, everything, nothing good to be said for him. But as soon as they knew that we spoke Spanish, they spoke to us in Spanish and they said the exact opposite. What they said was, es un santo. He is a saint. He is a very good man. He even pays for his cigarettes when he buys them in a shop. And we said to them, well, if Castro is such a saint, why are you here? Why have you left Cuba? And they said, because the work that we do, the skills that we have, are no longer needed in the new Cuba. And I said, what's that? And they said, well, you know, we make beautiful clothes and we have beauty salons and we do, we're landscape gardeners. And so our skills were not needed in the new Cuba. This is why we have fled through to Florida, to Miami, because we thought maybe a better life for us here. I don't know whether that's the truth, but this is what they said to us in Spanish language. Not in English, never in English, but only in the Spanish language did they say that. But there was always that feeling of the fear of communism. I think that was always there in the United States. And there was Castro, you know, so very close. I mean, you could always throw a stone across Cuba, so it was very close to Florida. And but it wasn't a violent sort of feeling. I can't remember that at all. I can just remember all those people, particularly the refugees in the motel we stayed in, saying these wonderful things about Castro. Es un santo. He's a saint. That's my main memory of those days. Because there was still a very strong anti-black feeling in America in those days. It was before the liberation of black people. You know, when you picked up the newspaper to see what movie to go and see, there were movies and then there were coloured movies. That meant they were for black people only.
Were you aware of the military build-up in Vietnam at that point?
No, don't remember anything about that at all.
It was beginning at that point.
It was beginning at that point, yes. Mm. No, I don't remember that.
Were you concerned about the Soviet missiles on Cuba? The Cuban Missile Crisis?
I can't remember us being concerned about that, no, I can't. But we were a politically minded family, but I can't remember, I can remember hearing about it, but I can't remember really taking it seriously. Mm. Because Khrushchev had been in New York and had taken his shoe off. Do you remember all that story? He'd taken his shoe off and he'd banged the heel of it on the table and said, we will bury you.
Mm-hmm.
I remember hearing all that.
Tell us a little bit about the negative things that you or Ed might have heard about Kennedy from people or associates.
Well, we only heard negative things about him over the Bay of Pigs. I remember us thinking, you know, that the Americans shouldn't have done that. We all thought that they shouldn't have landed troops there. And they got defeated, of course. But I remember that we talked about it and said they shouldn't be landing troops in somebody else's country like that.
So just sort of coming up to that time, just before Kennedy was shot.
For a week before, we had known something was imminent. We didn't know what it was, but we just had a feeling something's imminent, something's sort of going to happen, but we didn't suspect it might be assassination, of course. That was never mentioned anyway. But we knew something was going to happen, particularly because of this John Birch Society. It's a very powerful, you never hear of them today, do you?
Mm.
But it was a very strong movement there, and it was on television a lot.
If you could sort of backtrack and wind back the clock and imagine a world in which that event hadn't happened, how do you think it might have changed what you and Ed subsequently
did with
your life?
I think it made a very big difference, I think. Because I don't think, I'm only guessing now, of course, but I don't think that Kennedy would have acted in that same way over Vietnam and got America so deeply involved in a very wrong war. I don't think Kennedy would have done that, because he was a much admired young man, you know. He was a, you know, young America really so admired him. He was finally a different type of leader from the tired old politicians they'd had before. And, you know, there was such a strong feeling against America being involved in war and things. That was why, when America did become involved in Vietnam, there was such a strong movement against it. You know, all sorts of people, including Clinton, I mean, later on, you know, he was a conscientious objector and fled off to Canada so he wouldn't have to go to Vietnam. Yeah, so the elimination of Kennedy made a very, very big difference to American history, I believe. That was why we really left America, because the assassination was such a disgraceful event, so manipulated by the powers that be. You know, and they assassinated him, and then not too long after, do you remember, they assassinated his brother?
Yeah.
You know, who was of the same type of thinking. I think he was a good chap too. But they got rid of them all, and they put a Texan in charge. So, you know, when Kennedy was assassinated, who became the president? Johnson, a Texan. You know, speaking for all the Texan oil millionaires and everything.
You're listening to an interview which I conducted with my mother, Shirley, back in 2005. Our discussion rambled through quite a few different areas of interest. One of the main ones being in that lead-up to the Kennedy assassination, she was aware of a lot of groups who were talking about some kind of calamity that was approaching the US, and she was also aware of conspiracy theories at that time about groups such as the Illuminati that were allegedly trying to take over the world. Of course, some of these groups actually who were raising the alarm about this were blaming Kennedy and saying that he was actually a facilitator of these dark conspiracies. And one such group was actually the John Birch Society. Of course, these days, there are similar themes in US politics and political ideology, but the theme back then was very much communism and some sort of globalist cabal centred around that. Anyway, we're going to break. When we come back from break, I'll be continuing with the interview. Please stay with us. Are you getting fed up with all the disinformation, deception, spin, propaganda, half-truths and downright lies in mainstream news? Looking for something different? Visit Truth News Radio Australia, www.truthnews.com.au, and may the truth set you free.
No matter where you go in your life, at some point you're going to need somebody to stand by you.
Just as long as your people come and stand by.
Hi, welcome back to the show. I'll now continue with the interview between myself and my mother, Shirley Fenton, where she's talking about the lead-up to the Kennedy assassination and the forces and conspiracies and her perceptions of people at that time. A very interesting general overview of a very important period in history. So here we go with a continuation of the interview with Shirley Fenton.
Okay, well, as you know, at that time, we were living in Bakersfield, California. Ed was flying there, and some startling things really did begin to happen. This is before the assassination. We watched a lot of television like everybody else, and there used to be sayings coming on, particularly on their religious programs, about a great black cloud is coming over the United States of America. And we didn't know quite what, they didn't specifically explain what it was, but there was a, they were trying to get us to think that the United States was in a sense of imminent danger. But we didn't really know what it was until one day Ed came home from work and he said, you know, my loader driver who, you know, looks after the chemicals and things in the helicopter. He owns the helicopter, actually. He was quite a rich man. And he said, on the seat beside me in the car as we drove home, he had a big pile of papers, you know, about half a foot thick. And he said, one day I'm going to show you these papers, Ed, and it will explain to you how this country is in imminent danger of being taken over by the communists. And he said, the people, there's a group of people here called the Illuminati, and this is all explained in these papers, and they are very dangerous people here. And Kennedy is one of them, and so is the president of Mexico, and most of the heads of Europe all belong to the Illuminati. This is what, mind you, this is what I remember. And the Communist Party were all in it too, and they were in danger of overthrowing the good people of America. Well, you know, we sort of more or less laughed about it, really. It didn't seem feasible. And then, of course, would you like me to go on and talk about what actually happened on the day of the assassination?
Yeah, we might as well move forward to the actual assassination now, and you can just pick it up wherever you wish.
All right. Well, on that particular day, I was at the hairdresser, I remember, and it was a Friday, and Ed was home. And when I came in at about 20 past 12, he said, quickly, come in and sit down. Kennedy's been assassinated. Well, we started watching television from that time on, and we watched it from that Friday at lunchtime right through until Sunday night. I know, I suppose we did go to sleep somewhere, but it seemed to me we just never took our eyes off television. And when the first report started to come in about the assassination, it was clear that Kennedy had been assassinated by the oil barons of Texas. I mean, they even used those sort of words, not specifically saying names, but they talked about the power tower in, I think it was in Houston, Texas, which used to broadcast all over South America and was owned by the oil people. And it was sort of generally thought that, that they were the people who had got rid of Kennedy because, and this was spoken about on television, he had taken away the oil depletion allowance from the oil people in Texas. Now, the oil depletion allowance, I'd have to look it up to find out exactly what it was, but it was something to do with taxation and meant that the oil people would no longer get this general tax clearance. Because they were looking for oil and developing oil, and they would have to pay tax like everybody else.
So it was quite clear to you when the assassination occurred that the people who were trying to assassinate Kennedy came from within America.
Oh, yes, definitely. There was no talk about it being anybody outside. And I think it really wasn't till the next day, was it? I'm not really sure, that the story of Oswald suddenly appeared. And, you know, we were listening to all the famous commentators like Dan Rather and all those other people, and there was no suggestion there that there was any outside influence on the assassination.
Maybe you could just focus a little bit on how the television spectacle played out and how that changed people's perceptions of what had actually occurred.
Yes, well, we had friends in Bakersfield and we were talking to each other on the phone, and we all were agreed that it was something to do with the oil people and taxation. That's what it was all about. In the beginning, in that first afternoon, it was the oil people, and that's what all the commentators were saying. But gradually, by the next day, the reports that they were giving had totally changed. And it was no longer the finger being put on the oil people. It was being put on outside interference, communist interference in the United States. It changed. The whole tenor of the news stories changed. Now, I can't remember the actual sequence of the Oswald affair, but we then began to see and hear stories about him and how he was a loner. That was the whole point, the point they were making all the time. Kennedy was assassinated by a loner. It wasn't a group of people who'd killed him. It was this loner, this man who had lived for some time in the Soviet Union and was actually married to a Russian woman. I think we got big chunks of that. And we also heard reports, this is something I'd forgotten to tell you, we heard reports that when school children in Texas, or it might have been Mississippi, was somewhere there, were told by their teachers that Kennedy had been assassinated, they all burst into cheering and clapping. It's quite an amazing story, isn't it, when you think of it?
Do you remember being told that Oswald was the assassin?
Yes, he was called... This, I don't know, it wasn't the word assassin, was it? What word did they use? Murderer, was
Shooter?
It?
Shooter? Gunman?
Yeah, the lone gunman, I think it
right.
was, yes.
Was that news posted before...
Yeah, well, we were...
Oswald, was it actually a shot yeah. himself?
Yes, it was. He was always referred to as the gunman. You know, that sort of goes against Western law. You can't accuse people. You can say alleged if you want to, but you can't sort of actually accuse somebody of being
especially
something.
Especially at such an early stage of the investigation.
Yes, that's right. And that was on the Saturday. He was being referred to as the gunman. I think that was the word, gunman.
So Kennedy was shot on the Friday? Or?
Yes, Friday at lunchtime.
So by the Saturday, they'd already determined that Oswald
that was Oswald,
the
yes.
gunman.
Yes.
And then by the following day, Oswald was dead. Is that correct? Or did he...
He was killed on the Sunday morning.
Sunday morning.
Yes. Okay. But when we went to sleep on Saturday night, and then we immediately got up and turned on the television, and it said, they are now going to be taking Oswald... The gunman, or whatever he was called, from the police station to the courthouse for his trial. And Ed said to me, I can't believe it. He said, I thought they would have killed him. Mm. I can't believe he's still alive. On Saturday, we were quite sure that he would mysteriously die sometime on Saturday night because alive would be much harder to convict him than if he was dead. And then when we watch television, and here he comes walking out through this crowd of reporters with cameras and things, with a policeman on each side holding his arm, and he's walking down through this crowd.
And we're just heading to break, so please stay with us. We'll be continuing with this very, very gripping interview right after the next break.
She said she learned the hard way. Said she wanna spare the children. She said don't give a say your soul away, 'cause all that you have is your soul. So don't be tempted by the shiny apple. Don't you eat of a bitter fruit. Hunger only for a taste of justice. Hunger only for a world of truth. Cause all that you have is your soul.
Welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. And I'm bringing to you an interview from 2005 with my mother, Shirley Fenton. And she's just getting into the actual assassination of Kennedy, the subsequent assassination of Oswald, her perceptions, observations, and feelings about it. It's a very interesting interview. I do hope you find it worthwhile. I'll head now straight back into that. And please, if you do find this interesting, let me know. Send me an email. I'm very keen to hear your thoughts.
I think you know the story. And as all of a sudden, Ruby, who we got to know later, appears out of the crowd pointing a gun directly at him. And the two policemen holding him don't even look at him. I mean, their eyes don't look down and see this man coming at them with a gun. And he just shoots Oswald dead there, you know, on television. We actually saw him being killed on television. And then, of course, it was replayed and replayed many times. So I remember that scene very well. But I know that the two policemen must have known it was going to happen because they didn't even look, their eyes didn't look down at this man coming with the gun.
So it almost sounds like that event was like it was staged for television.
Oh, yes. Does, doesn't it?
And it's reminiscent of 9/11 in a strange way, because the first plane hits the tower, no one really sees that. Then all the cameras are pointing. The second plane hits the tower, and it's all filmed like
that's right. About 20 minutes later, wasn't it?
Yeah. Like a television spectacular event.
It was absolutely.
And also an event designed to make people feel very emotional.
Mm. Yes, that was a television event, all right. And I'll tell you another thing I've remembered that shocked us too. We saw a man from the New Statesman and Nation, that very respectable left-wing journal in London, being interviewed about it on that Sunday. And he was saying people have said that the Dallas police were somehow involved in the killing of Oswald. He said, well, we know for sure that the Dallas police would never be involved in anything like that. That was almost the last straw for us, to think that an English newspaper would think the Dallas police wouldn't be capable of doing
as
something like that.
As if they would have any opinion on it.
Yes, right. That was really a terrible shock to hear that. And Norris, what decided us to leave the country, I think.
So you were both pretty disgusted by...
Oh, and all our friends were too. We had a group of youngish friends there who were broken-hearted, actually, at the death of Kennedy, because he'd seemed like something new in American politics. You know, he was fresh and he had a world view. He was a travelled man. He'd been all over the world. And suddenly he is dead and he's replaced by a Texan who's never been anywhere.
So what did you think about Johnson?
Well, we just thought it's very odd, isn't it? The Texans are in control again.
Hmm.
Mm. And see, Kennedy had only taken him on as a running mate in order to get the votes, but it was obviously a mistake that he'd done that. He should have taken somebody else on. But maybe he wouldn't have been elected, of course. I don't know what all the politics are behind that.
You said that people were broken-hearted.
Well, our friends were, yes.
Yeah. But
I mean, they really were just personally about the man, yes.
Yeah.
Because he was popular with young people, very popular. He seemed fresh and young, and he had a world vision, the same sort of view that young people had of the world and things. Yes, he wasn't a tired old politician, you know, like Nixon, you know, crooked old people like that.
Now, I guess you and Ed and the family didn't stay much longer.
No, we didn't.
In California.
No. We
you
got out.
Left within a couple of months.
Yes. Well, that was so that November, wasn't it? Yes, I think we left in December or January. Yeah.
So that was a pretty big decision to make, to move so quickly, but you obviously thought it was...
Time to get out, we thought, yes, time to get out.
Well, were you aware of the build-up in Vietnam at that stage?
Well, I can't remember that we talked much about Vietnam, no. I can't honestly say that.
It might have been in the news a little bit, but it probably wasn't.
A little bit, yeah.
It was more advisors.
Well, see, it was 63, wasn't it?
Yeah. They didn't have a lot of ground troops there.
No.
But they did within within about 18 months they did.
Yes, that's right.
It all happened quite quickly after that, because by 65 they had 500,000. So, I mean, they must have really started almost immediately from that point. Do you remember anything about the Warren Commission? Do you remember talking about the Warren Commission?
Yeah, I do.
When you'd moved to New Zealand by the time that was
instituted to find out the truth about Oswald and the assassination, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yes, well, we read a lot and talked a lot about that because we felt that he'd been paid off, or, you know, it wasn't genuine. It wasn't a good commission, that. That's what we thought at the time anyway. And he'd either been bribed or he had been appointed because they knew what he'd give the result that they wanted. Yeah. And then, you see, Ruby, the murderer of Oswald, he died mysteriously too, you know. He died in prison. Why was he put in prison? Was he put in prison for shooting Oswald, I suppose, was he? And then nearly everybody connected whose names were used in that whole business died mysteriously. Yeah, there are about 10 people.
Yeah. And there's been about 100 others also who were more loosely connected who mysteriously died as well.
And the story that we had was that in American history, there must only always be a lone assassin. Like Abraham Lincoln was a lone assassin when it was probably not. It was probably a plot, really, that got rid of him. And then you see they got rid of his brother not long afterwards. How long after was that?
Now, were you aware of Bobby Kennedy's sort of plans to...
No, they just seemed like two good people to us at the time. You know, there was the brother who was the president, and then there was his young brother who's with all the children. He had about 10 children, I think. But, no, they seemed like the same sort of people, good people, worldview people. That was the difference about them, even though their father had been a bit of a crook. But the Kennedys themselves, the young family, seemed good.
Just one last thing is, like, what do you think that the effect of that was on, psychologically, on people like Ed, who were of that generation, who'd probably been in the Second World War, who'd fought for their country, and who had sort of aspirations for a better world, you know, having fought against fascism and the Japanese Imperial Army and all that, to see their country kind of descending into this, and then of course the Vietnam War, which started very soon after that, which seemed like, you know, a totally unjustified invasion of another country. What do you think that this had as a psychological effect on people like your husband?
Yes, well, I know he was always very critical of the people who came in after Kennedy was assassinated.
Yeah.
And, well, that's why we left the country and went to New Zealand. But he still had an interest in it. And just as another interesting little point, I know when his father died in Ohio and he decided he should fly home for the funeral, he went up to Auckland to get a visa, I suppose it was, even though he's an American citizen. And he said in the American consulate there were these pamphlets there, and everyone was urged to take one, and it was headed Invasion from the North.
Interesting pamphlets, eh?
Yes, there, for everybody to take. There. And I remember him bringing it back and showing it to us. He said, it looks as though this is the new thing. You know, Invasion from the North. This was Vietnam. As though that's where the next big problem is. It's going to be Vietnam. So this must have been what, when Johnson, the new president, decided that they'd have to have a reason. Well, something to do with a ship being bombed in the Bay of Tonkin or something, wasn't it?
A gunboat which was shot at thing in the Gulf of Tonkin.
Yeah, which gave them the excuse to go to war. Yeah. But this was it obviously come out to be handed all around the world, because this was just a little funny little town like Auckland, you know, a consulate in Auckland. But those pamphlets must have gone out all over the world, I imagine. Invasion from the north. I just remember those words.
Break here with Truth News Radio Australia. It's great to have your company today. You're listening here to an interview with Shirley Fenton, and we're getting into some really interesting topics. Hope you enjoy it. We'll be right back after the break, and we'll be going for the rest of the hour. Please stay with us.
Seems to me like they want us to be afraid, man. Maybe we just like being afraid. Just so used to it at this point that it's just a part of us, part of our culture. Security alert on orange. It's been on orange since 01, G. I mean, what's up, man? Can a brother get yellow, man? Just for like 2 months or something? Goddamn. Sick of that. Mic check. The groove is thick, so I'ma rhyme like a lunatic. I do this shit with an unassuming wit. The corporation conjured up the bass and the tempo. My name is Liv, that's the intro, now let's go. The flow of life growing strife into the mix.
Hi, welcome back here with Truth News. Well, we'll be continuing now with the interview with Shirley Fenton, and we're moving into the years following the Kennedy assassination, during which my family moved to New Zealand. We had been living in Bakersfield, California at the time of the assassination, but my father, as I mentioned earlier, had become very, very cynical and despondent and dissatisfied with the situation in America. He felt he'd been deceived and betrayed. He'd served in World War II. He was a Marine and he flew bombers. He was actually a Marine pilot in World War II, and he flew bombers over the Pacific. And he was quite patriotic as a young man, but the events of the Kennedy assassination and then the subsequent escalation of the war in Vietnam made him realize that there was something very, very wrong with the US. And while he was in New Zealand, my father became involved in some of the anti-war protest groups that were starting up at that time. And of course, you know, his background and his military career gave him a degree of importance and influence over people there. And I should point out that my father was very well aware of the incident in the Gulf of Tonkin, which preceded the build-up of military involvement in the US, and he was well aware that this was staged by the US. The Gulf of Tonkin incident, of course, has become something that is discussed a lot these days as an example of a type of staged false flag, kind of textbook example of how the military-industrial complex operates. I believe my father was quite advanced in his thinking at that time, that he was aware of it. I don't know if he had a lot of people to bounce ideas off. I think he came up with this understanding largely on his own, but it was pretty obvious if you looked at the facts, if you looked at the way the stories were reported, and then the way in which the what looked like, you know, the intention to get involved in Vietnam just built up inevitably. And we saw the same thing in Afghanistan, we saw the same thing in Iraq, and we're now seeing the same trends in relation to Syria and Iran. We see that they have an agenda, there's something they want to do, but there needs to be pretext, there needs to be triggering points that help this along. It's not really very clever, but a lot of people do have the wool pulled over their eyes and buy into it. Well, my father was one of the people who didn't buy into it, and I think that his skepticism and his deeper understanding of geopolitics helped me a lot in my understanding of the world as it is today.
So we'll just continue now with the interview, and this will be the final section of the show for today. I do hope you enjoy it.
We could see Ed, really, as you said, he'd been, well, I hate to use the word patriot because it's a terrible word, I think.
Yeah.
But he'd, you know, he'd been...
And he had fought in two wars.
He'd fought in two wars, yeah, that's right.
So he had
and he was American, yes, he was American. Yeah. But he saw its weaknesses because he even used to tell me about some of the terrible things they did over the war with Mexico. I forget what that was all about, that they shouldn't have done. They invaded Mexico, and a lot of that land in the Arizona and that area was taken back from the Mexicans. It used to be Mexican territory, apparently. Anyway, no, I don't know exactly about that. But that's when he decided we must do something and explain. So we used to get... Do you want to hear this?
Yeah.
He used to get Time magazine... And all the thing was Time magazine was critical of the war in the beginning, was it? Well, I think it must have been, because I remember him cutting out all bits and making a great big display board with all cuttings from Time magazine, American publications, being critical of what Johnson was doing about Vietnam. And he'd go into Napier, the town near where we lived, and stand out in the street with this big board and encourage people to come and ask him questions about it. And he had a thing saying, you know, I am a former Marine pilot, Marine pilot,
yeah.
And I just want to show you what the real truth of this Vietnam business is. We should not be going in there. It's all wrong. And he'd write letters to the newspapers, and he had a big fight in the newspaper, actually, with the Premier of New Zealand. Piggy Muldoon, his name was. He was all in favour of going to the war.
Was New Zealand involved in the war?
They were still talking about it, I think, yes.
Did they send troops in the end?
They did in the end, yes. Mm. They did in the, but that was under the very conservative government.
Mm.
And so we then formed this anti-Vietnam war brigade. We used to have meetings every night, sitting around from 10 o'clock at night till 2 and 3 in the morning, with lots of people all against it. And then what happened? Oh, being arrested and everything. That was when we got to Auckland. We were going to all protest meetings. See, there's no protest about Iraq, but in those days there were protests everywhere. There'd be hundreds and hundreds of people protesting in the street about, they must have brought in, maybe they brought in call-up for soldiers to go to Vietnam. We went against that, and we had a communist friend, forget what his name was now. He was very, very nice chap, and he was quite game, because he used to go to the pubs every Saturday morning selling the Daily Worker, the newspaper thing, and he was arrested. And the same thing as with Oswald, that story about him with the dirty T-shirt. He was kept in jail overnight, and dirty in his dirty old clothes and everything, and had to appear in court like that, not properly dressed. I mean, our experience in New Zealand was pretty fierce, really, because you were a baby then in a pushcart, and I can remember going to a protest meeting with the other children and you in the pushcart and pushing you forwards, and these big Alsatian dogs being sewled onto you. Mm. You know, they're only inches from your nose.
Mm.
Alsatian dogs. And I can remember the police chief being interviewed on television and being asked, you know, why all these people had been arrested at this protest meeting. You know, before, what are they guilty of? They haven't been tried or anything. He said, oh, we only arrest guilty people. You don't know what the feeling was like in those days. It's not like that now at all.
This was in little New Zealand.
Little New Zealand, yeah. This was, yeah. And then, of course, when we went to court over that, yeah. And then we got fed up with New Zealand then, of course, and then we went to Australia, and it was bigger than ever here. There were thousands and thousands of protesters. Like the whole of George Street and Park Street would be filled with people as far as the eye could see, saying Ho Chi Minh to win. That's what people used to say.
Do you see a big difference between that and what we've seen in relation to the war in Iraq.
Yes, I don't see any protest against it at all from people. I don't. And it was just the AICD, that's what it was. And it was comprised of all sorts of people, nuns and old ladies and old people as well as young people. It wasn't just students, you know, it wasn't anything like that. The Catholic Church was all against it. But why aren't they against Iraq? It's very strange.
Some people have said it's because there is no draft. If there was a draft, it would...
Yes,
it would
the draft was happen. Terrible. Then, of course, you know, your brother Tom was called up, of course, and very bravely became a conscientious objector with the help of the Quakers. He had a Quaker lawyer who helped him do all that.
Did you ever see any connection between Kennedy's assassination and the Vietnam War?
Would he have been in favour of it, you mean?
Did you see that...
Now, in those days, when we were in California, I don't remember that there was anything to do with Vietnam until I went to New Zealand. And we'd been there a couple of years then. When he came home with those pamphlets saying invasion from the north. That was obviously how they decided to go about it. You see, and they got us all in on side, even the New Zealanders, who are today such a, you know, appear to be a much more peaceful type of people than we are. But they were right in there too, yeah.
And that, ladies and gentlemen, is where we will have to leave the interview for today. There were more segments recorded, but that, I think, what you've heard there is the essence of it and gives you a really interesting glimpse into a very important period in history and also some of the factors which helped in my own education. We'll be back next week with another show, and I do hope to have some original interviews for you. And I do encourage you to take a look at our website at www.truthnews.com.au. Leave a comment, join our Facebook page, and send me an email if you've got anything interesting to tell me. And I'll leave you as we go out with this beautiful music by Augustine Barrios. Over and out from Truth News Radio Australia. We'll be back next week.